Hello, and welcome to another episode of Electrify This, a podcast focused on electrification as a pathway to decarbonize and revitalize our economy. Each episode, I connect with experts to explore the policy and market issues underpinning the shift to electrified transportation, buildings, and industry. I'm your host, Sarah Baldwin, Senior Director of Electrification with Energy Innovation. Today's episode, A Roadmap for the Zero Carbon Industrial Transition, part one of a three-part series. Did you know that industrial activity around the world is responsible for one-third of human-caused greenhouse gas emissions? In the U.S. alone, direct emissions from the industrial sector makes up 23% of our emissions. But of course, the industrial sector is also essential for producing the tools and products we need for our daily lives. Look around you and you'll see hundreds of things made possible by industrial processes, including building materials, appliances, and equipment that we use in our homes and offices. The industrial sector is extremely diverse, from food and beverage products, textiles and paper, and steel and concrete. But it also produces the very technologies we need to tackle climate change, like wind turbines, batteries, and EVs, among others. Yet despite its importance to our economy and its omnipresence in our lives, efforts to reduce industrial emissions are lagging when compared to other sectors. And a lot of people tend to dismiss industry as, quote, hard to decarbonize, assuming nothing can be done to mitigate the sector's impact on climate change. To date, we've really lacked a more comprehensive roadmap for industrial decarbonization. Until now. With this week's release of a new book titled Zero Carbon Industry, Transformative Technologies and Policies to Achieve Sustainable Prosperity, we have a new tool in hand, and I couldn't be more excited for today's episode with the book's author, Jeffrey Rissman. With Jeff's help, we're going to explore the wide world of industry and the technologies, policies, and market mechanisms necessary to reduce the industrial sector's emissions in the coming decades. And since this is a big topic, today's episode will be the first in a three-part series on the topic of industrial decarbonization and electrification. So you'll want to stay tuned for the next several episodes to learn more. So without further ado, I'm pleased to introduce today's guest. Jeffrey Rissman is the Senior Director of Industry at Energy Innovation, where he leads the company's work on technologies and policies to eliminate greenhouse gas emissions from the industry sector. He's the author of Zero Carbon Industry, Transformative Technologies and Policies to Achieve Sustainable Prosperity, and the co-author of Designing Climate Solutions, a Policy Guide for Low-Carbon Energy. In 2024, Jeffrey was appointed by Secretary of Energy Jennifer Granholm to serve on the Department of Energy's Industrial Technology Innovation Advisory Committee. Jeff's also the creator of the Energy Policy Simulator, which is an open-source computer model that quantifies the effects of various energy and environmental policies. And versions of the simulator have been developed for an ever-growing list of countries and regions and states. And previously, Jeff worked on policies supporting R&D for clean energy and efficiency technologies for the American Energy Innovation Council. Jeff, welcome to the show. It's so great to have you on.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you for the invitation. I'm excited to be here.
Well, we have so much to discuss today, and I am already loving the book. I've been reading it, and I got a preview of the book before it was finalized, but it's just great to see such a phenomenal opus of information. So I'm excited to talk about it. But before we do that, tell our listeners a little bit more about what led you down the path of focusing on the industrial sector in your career and to ultimately writing this amazing book.
Sure thing. So before I was working on industry here at Energy Innovation, I was working on computer modeling, where I was the original creator of the Energy Policy Simulator, computer model you mentioned, and was helping to adapt it along with my colleagues to various countries and regions. And one thing I kept observing was that the industrial sector was responsible for a huge chunk of the emissions in place after place. And yet the policy levers to deal with it were fewer and often weaker than the policies for other sectors. And in conversations I would have with policymakers and leaders around the world, they often would focus on how to decarbonize transport or buildings or electricity and wouldn't even be thinking about the industrial sector. So I realized there was this gap where more information was needed. And that led me to write this book to try to answer those questions and bring this important topic of conversation to the attention of people who can make a difference.
Well, it is absolutely a foundational book, and I'm confident it's going to have a huge effect in illuminating the importance of industrial decarbonization, but also, more importantly, helping people understand the how and how we actually do that, because I feel like a lot of folks just sort of scratch their head and say, I don't know, seems hard.
Totally. It's daunting or intimidating because the industrial firms manufacture millions of products using lots of processes. But as the book points out, you don't have to understand all of those in detail to understand what policies and technologies would be effective to decarbonize industry.
Yes, absolutely. And we're going to get into the weeds there. Before we do that, I want to have you explain a little bit of the kind of background context. So in the intro to the book, you really aptly highlight that there's a growing agreement that we must eliminate the human-caused greenhouse gas emissions for a livable climate for humanity. And we've really got to do this between now and the 2050, 2070 timeframe. And you point out that the global industry is really at the heart of this transition. Can you give us a little bit more explanation as to why this is?
Sure. So industry means the firms that manufacture everything like steel and cement and chemicals that go on to make plastics and fertilizers. And globally, industry is responsible for a third of human-caused greenhouse gas emissions, including emissions from electricity that is purchased by industry. If you exclude purchased electricity, industry is responsible for about a quarter of human-caused greenhouse gas emissions. So either way, it's an enormous share of the total pie, and it has to be addressed if we're going to be able to stop global warming and to stabilize the climate at any temperature whatsoever. So, but climate change is an urgent problem. We're already seeing severe impacts related to wildfires, heat waves, flooding, and sea level rise. So it's important that policymakers and business decision leaders begin working on this problem without delay. Industrial equipment often has long lifetimes. It can be 20 years or more that a large piece of industrial equipment will be operated before it's replaced. And so if we delay and when you start with the new policies that incentivize the adoption of clean equipment, that delays the end date by which you've cleaned it all up, even further.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you also point out really aptly that we need all industry to clean up and reduce emissions, but we are also reliant on industry for the very technologies that we need to solve climate. So there's such a circular reality there that we have to embrace, I think, versus, close our eyes and hope it goes away.
Absolutely.
So I really appreciate that you point that out, that we really have so much work to do that's important for our overall climate objectives.
Yeah, you're totally right. As I mentioned in the book, industry is responsible for making not just all the products we rely on every day, but electric vehicles and solar panels, wind turbines, and even the industrial technologies that will clean up industry itself. So, plus industry is a source of high quality jobs, manufacturing jobs, and an important economic engine in many places. So it's central to the question of climate change and the economy in a number of ways.
Yes, indeed. And I want to dive into that a little bit more because most of us sit around in our homes or offices or when we're out in the world, and we really don't think too hard about all the stuff, all the materials, all the inputs that go into every product, every tool, every technology. You did a great job of breaking this down for your readers, so I want to have you help us and the listeners better understand this. There's a conglomeration of many, many industries, as you point out, different types of industries and processes. So can you walk us through how you define industry and the different subsector categories that you provide in your book to help us better understand what this really means?
Absolutely. So there's no official definition that everyone agrees on for what is included in industry, but I focus on manufacturing, and that includes the big three in terms of emissions are iron and steel making, the chemicals industry, which takes fossil fuels called feedstocks and turns them into petrochemicals, and from there, the petrochemicals are turned into products that we use every day, like plastics or fertilizers or paints or detergents, personal care products. And then the cement and concrete industry, which is crucial for making buildings and infrastructure. But there are many other smaller emitters that are also part of the industry sector. I include refining, so converting crude oil and into refined petroleum products, as well as making products out of wood, making products out of purchased metal like cars and appliances, and pulp and paper, textiles, food processing and cooking, and so on. Are all of these count as the industry sector? I exclude extraction of oil and gas from the ground, and other natural resource harvesting. And I'm excluding fugitive emissions like natural gas leaked from wellheads or the natural gas system. If including those things, industry's share of global emissions would be even higher.
That's really helpful. And for me, as a non-industry person, helps me better navigate the topic. So I really appreciate that simplicity of the categories. So we've touched on the fact that the words complex and challenging and daunting often arise when we're talking about industry, especially industry decarbonization. Some would even say impossible. How did you approach the task in your book to make it more digestible?
So a key goal of the book is to make this, make the complexity of the industry sector understandable and make the problem tractable for policymakers and anyone concerned about how to solve the climate crisis, really. So it breaks things down in a number of ways. One is by emissions, and I mentioned the top three emitting industries. It also focuses, it mentions geography. For instance, China is the number one country in terms of industrial emissions, responsible for about 45% of industrial emissions worldwide. India, the United States, and the European Union would be number two through number four in that list, counting the EU as one emitter. And then within each section, so there's the big three industries, and the book talks about how they operate today, how do they use energy, what types, what are their sources of emissions, and how could they adopt new clean processes that still produce the goods we rely on, but without these damaging effects on the climate or, for that matter, conventional pollutants that cause human health harms like heart attacks and lung disease. After walking through the big three industries, though, the book has a section on cross-cutting technologies, meaning technologies that are useful across a wide swath of industries. In almost every case, pretty much every industry can use some of these technologies. These are things like energy efficiency, material efficiency, circular economy, which means putting goods and products to their highest and best use at each point in their life cycle. Electrification, which is, of course, central to the chat we're having today. Hydrogen and renewable fuels and carbon capture, which help to show how you can have a limited set of technologies that are able to decarbonize the entire industrial sector. And then it finishes with policies. Essentially, once the book explains how things are made today, and what are the technologies that could allow them to be made cleanly. The next question is, how do we ensure those technologies are commercialized and scaled up in an appropriate time frame to achieve our climate goals? And it really walks through the policies quite carefully with policy design guidelines and how to avoid loopholes, so that by the time you reach the end, even if you started knowing nothing about the industry sector, the hope is that by the end, you're something of an expert and you know the technologies and the policies, you know the roadmap, and you feel excited about what lies ahead.
Well, I will say that you have accomplished much of that goal. I wouldn't call myself an expert yet, but I do feel a lot more familiarized and definitely a lot more conversant on the topic. So thanks to your great work. So that's a great pivot, actually. This is, of course, a podcast devoted to the topic of electrification, and you highlight the importance of industrial electrification because the shift of the fossil fuel end uses over to run on clean electricity really is the most expedient and efficient way to provide zero carbon heat for some of these industrial processes. Walk us through the basics of how we would go about electrifying industry, and then we'll talk a little bit about some of the barriers and some of the challenges.
Sure thing. So electrification is an extremely important route for decarbonizing industrial heat. So industry uses fossil fuels today for two purposes, feedstocks and energy. Feedstocks, as I mentioned, are the input materials that go into the chemicals industry mostly and are physically transformed into different petrochemicals and petrochemical products. Those can't be directly electrified because they need mass or material. But the larger share of fossil fuels used by industry are burned for heat and energy, almost all of which is for heat. Some for heating boilers to produce steam, and some for a variety of other industrial processes like melting metals or calcining limestone to make cement or driving chemical reactions. And so the few uses of fuel that are burned by industry for energy but not for heat, let's say to drive a diesel engine, they're fairly easy to electrify with technologies that are often common from other sectors, like an electric motor. So really the central challenge when it comes down to electrifying industry is electrifying industrial heat or processes. So the book devotes a chapter to this and talks about electrified heating technologies, things like industrial heat pumps or thermal batteries or electromagnetic induction or electric arcs, like in electric arc furnaces, and several others, which I'm happy to chat more about if you'd like. But one commonality across all these electrical technologies is that they're more efficient than their fossil counterparts. Because when you're burning a fossil fuel, or hydrogen for that matter, a lot of the heat is lost in the hot exhaust gases. And also they form water vapor as a combustion byproduct, which is a molecule that has energy in it, latent heat, and carries it out of the system when the water vapor escapes. So if you're using electricity directly, there is no combustion byproduct gas, and it doesn't form any water vapor. So a lot of that, more of that heat stays where you want it, heating the product or material that you care about. Then a couple technologies like thermal batteries and heat pumps have special tricks that make them even more cost-effective than other electric technologies.
Do tell, for example.
Sure. So industrial heat pumps are somewhat similar to heat pumps your listeners might be familiar with from the building sector. They move heat from one place to another, like your refrigerator or your air conditioner. But unlike a refrigerator, the part that you care about is the place where they're delivering the heat to, which would be the back of the refrigerator. But for the heat pump, it's sending heat to an industrial process. industrial heat pumps can deliver heat at up to about 165 Celsius. 100 Celsius is enough to boil water, so it's more than enough for a lot of industrial uses, such as cooking food and various processes in the textiles, or even surface finishing of metal parts and other things. About a third of all of the heat that's currently provided by burning fossil fuels is at temperatures that could be provided by industrial heat pumps. And they are super efficient because they only are moving heat from one place to another instead of creating it. So they can deliver more usable heat than the amount of electricity you put in to operate them, between 2 and 5 times more usable heat, depending on exactly how hot the output temperature is. So that greatly improves their economics. It cuts the cost of supplying electricity to them down into a half or a fifth of what it would be if you were using an electrical resistance heater, which is operating at roughly 100% efficiency on this scale. Thermal batteries have a different trick to lower energy costs. So a thermal battery is a collection of material that can get hot without chemically breaking down, such as graphite blocks or silicon dioxide sand, encased in a highly insulating layer that prevents heat from escaping. There are wires that run into the thermal battery, and those wires are electric resistance heaters that you run a current through them, which can come from electricity from the grid or from an off-grid wind and solar project, and it'll heat up that material, the graphite or the silicon dioxide. And losses are very slow because the insulation is very good. When the industrial facility wants the heat, they will either pump a gas through the channels in the storage material, often air, and that will heat up the air and then take it into the facility and use it for the industrial process. Or they can open shutters in the insulated case to let out energy in the form of infrared and visible light. The efficiency can be up to 95% from electricity to delivered heat, even after storage in the battery for a day or multiple days. And they cut electricity costs, whether or not they're being used on-grid or off-grid. If they're being used off-grid, you have wind and solar, a dedicated project, which is, in many places, the cheapest form of electricity you can get. But it's variable, and industrial firms often want to run either all the time or when their workers are available in certain hours. So the thermal battery allows them to take extra electricity when it's sunny and windy and store it as heat and use it when there's less sun and wind to help ride out the periods of less favorable weather. The grid-connected thermal batteries are similar, except they are purchasing electricity in the hours when it's cheapest, and they allow the industrial facility to avoid purchasing electricity from the grid in the hours when it's more expensive. Either way, on-grid or off-grid, it cuts electricity costs down to one-half or one-third of the cost it would be if you just purchased the electricity in every minute when you needed it straight from the grid. So they can greatly help close any cost gap between electricity and fossil fuels.
That is all super helpful, and I'm sure for most people, heat pumps are the more familiar technology. Thermal batteries is a bit more novel, hasn't necessarily been mainstreamed yet. Do you know of a place that's using the thermal batteries today, or is that still needing more R&D or commercialization to get more prominent?
Thermal batteries, at least of the sort that we're talking about, which are used for industry, are quite new. There are a number of companies that are manufacturing them, but these companies are typically startups at small scale. Two that are near me here in the Bay Area are Rondo Energy and Antora Energy. There's several in Europe. I believe there's one in Australia. So there are a few deployments. I know that I think it's Craftblock, one of the European ones, has had a deployment. I believe Antora and Rondo may have recently or are working on their first commercial deployments. But it's at quite small scale because it's such a new technology. There are older thermal storage technologies, often based on molten salt, which were used in concentrating solar thermal power plants to help make them able to provide power more reliably, even in times when it's less sunny or at night. But though that technology was more expensive and more limited, the thermal batteries that we're talking about using these inert storage materials can deliver much higher temperatures, up to 1500 or even 1700 Celsius, which is enough for most industrial processes by far, and are smaller scale and don't have some of the challenges associated with corrosive molten salts. So for a variety of reasons, they're much more accessible, more smaller and less expensive, and are very promising, but they need time and money to scale up.
That makes sense. I really appreciate that explanation, and every time I hear you explain things, I understand them better. So you're very good at simplifying these very complex things. To that end, I really want to give a shout out to one of the tables you provide in the book that really helpfully breaks down the different industrial activities, the temperature range that they require, the example industry that they are within, and then the electrical technologies that could be applicable to meet those heat needs with an alternative. Because that, to me, is really the end-all be-all of the industrial electrification opportunity with respect to helping people understand it's not just one technology that's going to fit all. There are myriad technologies. You mentioned a few: electric arc furnaces, electric resistance, plasma torches, induction, infrared heating, et cetera, and they all have different applications and can be used to substitute for the fossil fuels that are currently being used to provide those same functions. So that's really cool. Thanks for doing that. I'm just going to put that table up on my wall and memorize it.
We're lucky to have such a wealth of electrified heating options, which are already understood and researched. And so a lot of the challenge is just adapting them to equipment in different industries. You know, we already understand how to use electric arcs or microwave heating or electric resistance heating. We just need manufacturers of industrial equipment to commercialize models that rely on these technologies where they don't already do so.
Absolutely. Well, maybe we'll see some of this unlocked with new Inflation Reduction Act funds and incentives for this manufacturing renaissance that we're seeing already. I want to chat just a little bit about the barriers, because obviously it's not all pie and honey and roses and all the good stuff. You note that, you know, the barriers are not as much on the physical side or even the technology side, but more on the economic side. Can you explain that a little further for folks who may not be as familiar with the ins and outs of that?
Sure. So most of the cost of these energy-using technologies, like furnaces and boilers, is in the fuel or energy that they use. The capital equipment, over the long lifetime of a boiler, say, could only be a few percent of the total lifetime cost. So a lot of the cost comes down to the efficiency and the cost of the energy source they're using. And today, electricity is more expensive than natural gas or coal per unit of energy contained in the fuel. That cost challenge is perhaps the most important one regarding industrial electrification. The heat pumps and the thermal batteries use technical means to help lower that cost difference by exceptional efficiency in the case of the heat pumps, or buying unusually cheap electricity in the case of thermal batteries. And all electrical technologies tend to be more efficient than their fossil equivalents by to at least some degree. But even after closing the cost gap, especially if you're not using a thermal battery or heat pump, fossil fuels still end up being a little cheaper than electricity after the efficiency adjustment for some of these applications. So there's that is part of the role for good, strong policy. So policy can help these electrical technologies become commercialized, move them down their learning curves, lower their costs, and also help them compete on a fair and level playing field, since fossil technologies today have unfair advantages. They don't have to pay for the climate damages that they cause, nor the human health damages, such as the thousands of Americans that die every year from particulates and nitrogen oxides and sulfur oxides emitted from fossil fuel combustion. If those were valued appropriately, fossil fuels would already be significantly more expensive than electricity. So policy can come in and help with innovation, help with reducing the costs of clean technology, provide financing. There's many ways that policy can help.
Yes, and I really appreciate that you carved out so much space in the book to talk about the policies without going into detail about all of them, because there are many. Are there any that you see as most critical to getting this broader industrial decarbonization movement really underway, and maybe focus on the U.S. since our global context is far more difficult from a policy standpoint?
Sure. One of my favorite policies, well, let me start by saying different policies are most appropriate for technologies at different points in their life cycles. So, you know, there's research and development support, which is often good early on. There's some policy like carbon pricing, which is best later once there's already a commercialized clean option that firms can switch to, because the goal of carbon pricing is to incentivize a switch to clean processes. And if there's not a commercialized option, the firms will just pay the carbon price rather than switch, which isn't really the goal. So one of the messages of the book is that there isn't a silver bullet. There isn't one policy that is perfect at all times and all places. But that said, one of my favorites is green public procurement. So that's a policy where government uses its own purchasing power in order to create a market for clean products. You may not realize that governments are very important buyers of key high emissions industrial products like steel and cement, which is used in concrete. Those things go into public buildings like offices and public schools and such, as well as roads and other infrastructure. And so government, because they're spending their own money, they can decide to set aside some of that to help foster clean and innovative new technologies. Let's say a government that's purchasing steel or funding projects that purchase steel can set aside 5% initially of its steel purchases to come from innovative, zero carbon primary steel production, meaning, let's say, from clean hydrogen or electrolysis of iron ore. And then a steel manufacturer sees that there's a market for this. There's going to be able to sell the product, and that gives them a reason to install a new machine, a new production line that produces steel in this way. And then they can sell it to government. As they scale up their production, costs can come down, and their availability can go up, and then government can ratchet it up. Then maybe they'll buy 10% and then 20% of their steel from these processes. And then the steelmaker can break into the private market and start selling to other firms, let's say automakers that want clean steel for their cars. So it really helps get a technology started in a way that gives some certainty to the manufacturer that there's going to be a market for this, and links the payments to the actual provision of clean materials rather than speculatively funding a company's expansion plans, say.
That makes a lot of sense. And yeah, the lead by example policy has been so effective in so many other arenas, so it would make very much sense that this would be no exception to that, especially when you consider how much, at least in the U.S., I haven't seen the figure lately, but I do know that our tax dollars go to pay hefty energy bills in all of the facilities that our U.S. government owns and operates, and so it would have a net benefit for taxpayers in reducing O&M costs for longer term as well.
Yeah, I think for something like a building, the best way to look at it is holistically. What are the energy impacts and emissions impacts across the building lifetime, including the materials the building is made of and when those materials were made, as well as the energy the building will use while in service? I like that framing.
Great. Well, as usual, our time is going very quickly, but I want to get to a few more questions before we round out our time together. While we're still on the topic of policymakers, you know, you point out in the book that they are often or have historically been more hesitant to take on the policy and regulatory actions that are necessary to address emissions from industry. Help us understand a little bit more about why that is and what's needed to help increase the ambition among policymakers out there and inspire them to be leaders in this space.
I think there's two main factors, or maybe three. One is the visibility of the industry sector. You see cars all the time. You see your buildings, your houses. You may not see power plants, but they're in the news a lot, and you see solar panels on roofs. But you don't really see the production lines where plastics are made or cement. Another is the concern over complexity, and we've already covered that in an earlier question, how I break down the industry sector in different ways and try to help people understand this is not too complicated to be understood. It can be broken down in a way that makes it very actionable for policymakers and others. The third element, the one we haven't really discussed yet, is jobs and competitiveness. So I think some policymakers are worried about regulating industry because industry is such a large source of high-quality jobs and contributes to the economy, and they don't want to jeopardize that. Fortunately, a transition to clean industry is compatible with strong domestic industries and technological leadership and expansion of job opportunities in the United States or in any country that really embraces this transition. There's a lot of risk in not doing so. We're seeing strong movement by governments and purchasers toward wanting materials that are produced in a clean way that that is compatible with the what we need to do to stop dangerous climate change. For instance, the European Union has implemented a carbon border adjustment, which will charge fees on products imported into the European Union if they were made in a dirty way. And there have been several proposals for carbon-based border taxes in the United States. None of them is yet law, but they very well may be. And increasingly, there's demand for these from businesses, from automakers, from consumers. So in businesses that invest now will secure more technological leadership in these clean processes, will be able to sell their products into all of these markets, into government clean procurement programs as well is another one. And all of this investment flowing into productive equipment and workers is what creates jobs. You know, today, if you purchase fossil fuels, the fossil fuel industry has a low labor intensity. Fairly little of the dollars actually go into workers' pockets. You know, imagine an enormous oil tanker piloted by a small handful of people and their salaries versus the cost of the oil tanker and the fuel it burns to operate it and such. And some of that, the fossil fuels, oil in particular, are still imported, even though we are now a major producer. And those dollars go abroad. So you can generate more jobs by spending in domestic communities on productive capital equipment that boosts the productivity of domestic workers, improves energy efficiency, and directs what the energy purchases to the electricity sector, which is all produced domestically.
Yeah, I agree. And I think more education around those interconnected pieces is really going to be helpful and needed to help people really connect those dots. So you're going to have more conversations on more podcasts, I guess.
I guess so.
I don't want to leave out a really important topic that you cover in the book extensively, which is equity and human development and the importance of a transition to clean industry that can redress inequities and improve the lives of people in especially historically marginalized communities and countries. Without going into a ton of detail, what are some of the core tenets that folks should keep in mind in order to ensure this equitable and net beneficial transition?
Thanks for making time for it. I know we're coming up on the end here, but it is such an important topic because a clean industrial transition that achieves our climate goals can't happen in just one or two countries. It really has to be global, and it has to leave no countries and no communities behind. And there are key things that policymakers can do to help foster this transition globally. My book discusses local leadership in low and middle income countries that are seeking to industrialize and want to do so in a clean way, leapfrog over dirty industry, which will cause lots of public health impacts and many deaths if they were to implement a dirty industrial processes. They also have other policy goals working with them to ensure that that they take leadership and that they understand the local context, their goals are met. There are principles in the book regarding intellectual property licensing and making sure that firms globally have the rights they need, as well as the education and talent in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and financing and investment flows to low and middle income countries. The book then takes a step to a smaller scale and looks at communities within countries, communities that may suffer from disinvestment or that maybe are very dependent on one or two large industrial employers that are currently employing dirty processes. How do we help those industries retool and adopt cleaner processes while continuing to operate in their communities, providing jobs, and perhaps bringing some industry to communities that do suffer from underinvestment today? And making sure those benefits flow, whether that's through protections of public health, local hire agreements, local training agreements, investment in infrastructure such as electrical lines and transformers that can bring power to those new facilities, and supports like that.
Yeah, and you really point out in the book, and I really appreciate it, that this transition can be equitable, can be net beneficial, but it will not happen on its own, that we have to be very intentional in policy design and in bringing along the necessary workforce training and education components that feed into a broader transition. So kudos to you for incorporating that into the book and the research, and hopefully that will be helpful for many people who have that question. So my final two questions for you. First is, after doing all this research, writing the book, do you feel confident that this task of reducing industrial emissions at scale is feasible in the coming decades?
Yes. I think the process of writing the book and researching, it's very hopeful. It makes me aware of this wealth of amazing technologies that dedicated scientists and engineers are working on that can produce all of the products we need in a clean way, all of the policymakers who are becoming very interested in this and in identifying ways to use smart policy to make sure these technologies are commercialized and scaled up in the world, and not to mention the important role of journalists and podcast hosts in getting the information out to the people who need it. It's really a team effort, and I see movement on all of these fronts every day. So I am hopeful that this can and will happen in a time frame that will protect our climate.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, and I too feel more confident and certainly more empowered to do something about it, knowing more and having this book as such an excellent resource. So now your book is published. What's next? What are you going to do now? Take a vacation or?
Well, I should, but there's, I don't have one plan just yet because there is a lot to do. Mm-hmm. There are certainly there's some interesting products coming out from the industry program at Energy Innovation. Quite soon, we're going to release an industrial decarbonization calculator, a tool that helps estimate resource requirements for decarbonizing industry in various ways, including electrification. We also have a large project coming out, a collaboration between us and Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory on electrifying industrial heat in China, and a similar one between us and two groups in Europe on electrifying industrial heat over in Europe. Then beyond that, there are other ideas for more products, and we're always interested in any way we can support policymakers who want to make a difference in terms of accelerating the move toward clean industry.
Well, no doubt this will be a catalyst for much action and inspiring for those of us out there who've been doing the climate work for a long time. This is a new field ripe for innovation and ambition. So I'm excited to see what you and your team accomplish and our team collectively at Energy Innovation and all the partners that we work with. So, Jeff, this has been a great conversation. I'm really glad to have the opportunity to speak with you about the book. Congratulations once again. And thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Well, thank you. And for your listeners, if you want to learn more about the book, you can go to zerocarbonindustry.com. It has previews of the book content, links to where to buy it, and even a 20% off discount code for your listeners. So again, that's zerocarbonindustry.com. And thank you so much, Sarah, for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Awesome, Jeff. Well, we will definitely be sure to put that link in the show notes. And with that, I will bid you adieu. And Electrify This is an Energy Innovation original podcast. Energy Innovation is a nonpartisan energy policy firm delivering high-quality research and analysis to help policymakers and regulators pursue a decarbonized energy future. You can find out more about Energy Innovation and the podcast at energyinnovation.org/electrify this. And feel free to send us an email anytime at electrifythis@energyinnovation.org. I want to give a special thanks to all of you who took our survey, gave us your thoughts on the podcast, and provided your suggestions. We'll be integrating some of your feedback in future episodes, so be sure to stay tuned. And I am ever grateful for those of you who tune in regularly and continue to share the podcast with your friends and family. And we really appreciate our listeners, so thanks for tuning in. And of course, thanks to our sound engineer, Rowan Stigner, for all his excellent support over the years for the podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Baldwin, and you're plugged in to Electrify This.